You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Woke up today to the trending Twitter Santa Clarita. And I'll tell you, the first thing I thought of was that bad Netflix series with Drew Barrymore, where she's evidently a zombie. And they go around killing people and eating people. And I go, well, you know, it's maybe they canceled it. Maybe they brought it back. And then I, unfortunately, and I wish it were that simple. I wish that's what it was, to be honest. We find out today another shooting, the 19th school shooting this year. And again, it's another one of these moments where we can get nothing done. And there are some, to me, some very common sense things on the gun front that we should be undertaking. Background checks being one of them. But the other part of it is you know, I'm sitting here going, how does a 16-year-old kid get a 45 semi-automatic pistol? How does a 16-year-old kid get a gun? How is that possible? Well, you know, we guns are a generational thing. We pass it down from father to son. Look, no. No. I said today on Twitter, the first thing that should happen is whoever owned the gun, you arrest them, you charge them. You try them, you convict them, and you throw them in jail. It's time to start sending messages to people, especially we parents, who evidently just leave guns around for our kids to go and use. That should be the minimum. And of course, I know, I get this all the time when I say this, because I say this all the time. If someone takes your gun and uses it in a crime, it's your gun. You are responsible for it. So being responsible for it, because do you remember when Republicans used to be the party of personal responsibility? Do you remember that? I know I'm a little bit older and I'm getting older by the day, but I remember, you know, the conservatives who were the institution people, the personal responsibility people. Now it's like, well, no, we can't hold anyone accountable. When did that happen? Because the first thing someone says to me is, well, you know, I'll remember that the next time someone steals your car. I'm going, stealing is one thing. Here's the thing, though. If I leave my keys in the car and I leave it running and someone steals it, am I still not culpable? Because it's kind of stupid. You know, look, obviously, if someone steals your gun, your car or your gun or anything, and you report it, You did something. But to say that, you know, I just left it laying around and, you know, loaded. Sorry, I'm not going there with you. And this is, again, where common sense seems to be completely lost. To me, in this situation, if you left this gun around, this kid picked it up, took it and shot and killed people at school for whatever reason, and they have no idea why. You know, every report that I've read seemed like he was a decently liked kid, wasn't bullied. There were none of the red flags that you would see. I guess his father did pass away not too long ago. I guess that could be a stressor. But, you know, to go and say, I'm going to go and I'm going to borrow the gun and I'm going to go shoot up the place, and then ultimately, like, it's just insane. And this is where, in a responsible society with adult behavior, the first thing, the minimum thing, should be whoever owned the gun's responsible, because it shouldn't have been accessible. And I know everyone says, but, you know, Rick, it's my right. It is your right to own a gun, but it's also your right to be responsible for it. And for the people who say, well, you know, if someone takes your car and kills a bunch of people, should you be responsible? Yes, you are responsible. If I lend you my car and you go careening down the road and killing people, guess what? I'm going to be held responsible too. It seems we've lost our mind in this country over this gun issue. And, you know, the thing is, I go back to my childhood. Guns weren't everywhere. the saturation of guns in our society has really, really brought this stuff on. When I was a kid, not everybody had a gun. And if you saw somebody with a gun, somebody was going to die. It was that simple. Learned that from a very young age. And now I know I live in a different area today where you can see somebody with a shotgun in their gun rack, and you see people going to and from the free gun range down the road and all that. I get the differences. I get that there's a cultural thing. I get that. But what happened to the responsibility thing? This is my problem. Look, I walk through the sporting goods store. There are tons of things, these big metal boxes. They're called gun safes. I know we've seen them. You could put them in there. And they have these other little things they're called trigger locks. I'm sure we've heard of these. And we also have technology. We have new technology today that has a fingerprint. You can put a fingerprint and unlock the gun. We have abilities to do all kinds of stuff. But there is a political party in this country owned by a certain lobby group who will allow nothing to happen. So today, with the backdrop of this, of another one of these shootings, another deadly tragedy, another series of families whose loved one is not going to come home, and who for the rest of their lives are going to be left empty because of this day. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut sought to bring up the universal background check bill, H.R. 8, which had been passed in the House back in February. And I think that's important to remember, because the Republican who blocked all this, the woman from Mississippi, Senator Cindy Hyde Smith, she was saying, well, you know, we can't be hasty. We can't be hasty here. She said, quote, if this so-called common sense bipartisan legislation was indeed crafted with strong bipartisan input, it shouldn't have any problem advancing by regular order. Many questions about this legislation need to be answered before it's forced upon law-abiding gun owners. I can't get a piece of legislation to the floor in any other way other than this motion. But here's the thing. February, damn it. It's been sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk since February. So they say, we can't do this. We have to do it, the right way. You had the chance since February. And look, if you bring it to the floor, you debate it, and it gets voted down, fine. We'll deal with that when that happens. But this didn't even get a vote. This is my problem in all of this. There's all of this outrage. There's all of this, something has to be done. And you get Republicans, I wish, wringing their hands going, I wish there was something we could do. And then ultimately they do what? Nothing. Until the next time. I mean, I didn't even see hopes and prayers today. Didn't even see thoughts and prayers. Did not see. So I guess we're beyond the thoughts and prayers stage now. It's just like, Thursday. Another day. And it's crazy to me. Now, look, I'm not a gun grabber. I'm not someone who says we need to get rid of all the guns, round them all up. I am someone that says we should have sane, rational background checks. And I think House Resolution 8 is not a bad suggestion. Maybe we should know who has the guns, how they change hands. Because under current federal law, the only time a background check is done is if you go to a licensed gun dealer. If I go to the local store and I go, you know what, I'd really like to have that military assault weapon, they'll do a background check. But if I decide that I want to buy one out of the trunk of somebody's car, evidently I don't. And I know, here's the thing. It's a gun. I have the God-given constitutional right to my gun to bear arms. And that's true. But we've already decided that gun control is perfectly legal in this country, that we can set the line at what is and what is not accessible to the public. outside of the fact that, you know, we can't have, you know, stealth bombers and Javelin missiles and all kinds of stuff like that, we should be having a conversation of, you know, what kind of guns we have. But also, we should be talking about personal responsibility. We should be talking about, especially in a case like today, who's responsible for this? I know. Guns don't kill people. People do. I get that. But if this kid didn't have access to a gun, we wouldn't be having this conversation. And I know. But Rick, he could get a knife. And I'll tell you, you know, I would, frankly, I'll take my chances with somebody wielding a knife than a gun. I might have a chance of running away, maybe. I might have a chance of fending them off in some way, but with a gun, chances are not. So I'm struggling with this because I do understand that gun nuttery is part of our culture. I do understand that hunting is a big thing in our culture. And it is a family bonding thing. I get that. And nobody wants that to stop. Or at least nobody that I know. And I don't advocate for it. But the reality is I want, you know, sensible, law-abiding gun owners to be able to have their arsenal. But they got to be responsible for it. You know, in the past, we've heard this stuff before. You know, a kid gets upset, goes to grandpa's arsenal and borrows a bunch of stuff. Somebody has to be held responsible. And for me, that's the bottom line in this. And I get people going, well, we shouldn't have background checks because, you know, the government can't know we have guns. And I'm like, you know, I'm sorry. We're beyond that. We're beyond that. Nobody's coming around, knocking on doors, kicking in doors, taking people's guns. But I got to tell you, I think my kid's safety, the ability of my child to come home at the end of the day, that supersedes your right to have an arsenal and to leave guns laying around for some kid to pick up. I'm sorry. You know, it's like when you see these stories of, you know, two kids found a gun in the house and one kid shoots the other kid. Oh, it was an accident. No, wasn't an accident. Somebody should go to jail. And for me, it's always been the person who owns it. You bought it. You own it. You're responsible for it. To me, it doesn't get any simpler than that. You own it. You're responsible. Whatever happens to it. And look, again, someone steals it, you report it. And the problem is if you have so many guns that you can't report it because you don't know it's missing, you don't need to have that many guns. Sorry. You know, if my car is stolen and I don't report it and it's involved in a crime, guess what happens? They come for me. And I know, again, like I said, guns and cars are different. You have to register your car. Maybe we should be talking about that. Maybe we should be talking about returning to a culture of responsibility. Because we used to have that. People used to be responsible. And I know how the right always loves to say, you know, we live in this time of you know, victims and safe spaces. And I want to know when we moved into an era of nobody's responsible for anything, especially my gun nuts. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Look, it is a horrible tragedy, and we see this far too often. And it's at some point... It's never going to stop, understand that. But at some point, it's got to at least slow. And the gun issue is something that really has to be addressed. Well, again, I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, and talk a little bit about jobs, the economy. Trump had that little spiel at the New York Economic Club about how great things are. And yet most people are still struggling. I'll take a quick break. When we come back, Christian Weller is going to be here to share some thoughts on the economy and maybe how we shore things up. Right back. Stick around. Nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win.
On the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1978. That was the day OSHA published its lead standard. The standard reduced the permissible exposure by 75% to protect nearly a million workers from damage to nervous, urinary, and reproductive systems. As early as 1908, Alice Hamilton, the mother of occupational medicine, noted that lead had endangered workers as far back as the first half century after Christ. In their book, Deceit and Denial, The Deadly Politics of Industrial Pollution, historians Gerald Markowitz and David Rosner add that throughout her distinguished career, Hamilton was deeply involved in uncovering the relationship between lead and disease in the American workforce. Hamilton's groundbreaking research on the effects of lead paved the way for a growing uproar against its continued use. After the Occupational Safety and Health Act passed in 1970, occupational and public health activists pushed hard for a lead standard. A new generation of industrial hygienists emphasized how unsound, industry-driven conclusions regarding safe lead levels impacted women workers and workers of color. Industry had long asserted that women and African Americans were simply more susceptible to lead poison, which served to justify discrimination in hiring. Some unions accepted these terms, if only to demand a stringent lead standard that included immediate implementation of engineering controls. But leading hygienists like Gene Stelman blasted these arguments. Stelman insisted such conclusions reflected racial and gender bias rather than any credible scientific evidence. She added that men, women, and children, regardless of race or ethnicity, were all adversely affected by lead exposure. The final standard adopted was considered a compromise. Discrimination in hiring has continued and enforcement proves difficult. But even a watered-down standard was too much for the lead industry. They have been fighting it ever since.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we've all heard the money can't buy happiness argument. And I've always thought that was a bunch of bunk. Money might not be able to buy happiness, but at least buy a little stability, maybe a little sanity, just a thought. That usually comes from people who have money. Sadly, you ask somebody who's struggling to keep a roof over their head or food on the table, and they'll tell you a completely different story, which is why when I came across this article over at Forbes magazine, which right in line with everything I've been saying for almost every moment I've been doing this show, the article titled Unions Not Companies Deliver Real Stability, Real Stable Financial Security. Of course it does. That's why I've asked its author, Christian Weller, to come talk with us. Christian is a professor of public policy at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, also a senior fellow over at the Center for American Progress. Christian, thanks for taking time for us.
Always fun to talk to you, Rick.
So you start off your article with the premise that I've made all the time. Nothing is given. There's no benevolent employers. Everything is demanded and fought for and negotiated for, and we need more of it.
That's correct. And we need to fight back at this point against the employer saying that they are willing to be more benevolent. And we have now seen sort of the business roundtable, and we've seen some of the business-friendly advocacy groups saying, well, let the employers do a little bit more, and it's good for the workers, it's good for the bottom line. And yeah, maybe, but clearly, why should we all of a sudden start trusting businesses, large corporations that have ripped off the American working class for 30, 40 years, just because now they actually need to pay a little bit more. They may change their mind here and there, but in the end, it's only when workers band together in a union that we get sort of real sustained wealth. And I'm not saying this just from a political perspective, because I believe in unions and believe that's right. My colleague David Madeline and I have actually done the research on this, and we cite that in this article. We've looked at Federal Reserve Bank data broken down by union members versus non-union members, and it turns out that union members have a lot more wealth than non-union members, and typically because they have more stable jobs.
Right. And you know, and they usually end they end up making higher wages. The union advantage is about 30% higher in compensation. Along with much better health care benefits that give health security, and also something still of a defined benefit, still today even a little defined benefit, which leads to retirement security. So ultimately, not to mention job security as well, where you can't just be fired for being at will.
All of those factors. Let me just say, we actually control for income levels in our research, and the union wealth premium is about 70% to 80%, depending on which time period you're looking at. So there's a much larger gap on the wealth side than there is on the income side, and that holds true even after you control for income. So there is something here, and we've now looked at this in multiple different ways. What are the mechanisms that lead to it? Yes, there is higher income, but the other part is also unions negotiate for other benefits, and one of them, there are a number of benefits. One of them, as you mentioned, are the defined benefit pensions. They play an important role. But the other mechanisms that we often overlook is unions provide safety and stability. You're no longer an employee at will. When the employer changes their mind, there is a mechanism to individually talk about an individual employee. Or there is also a mechanism when an employer sort of says, okay, well, business is going down, how are we going to handle that? There is a mechanism to negotiate over that, and that shows up in the numbers. The average length with an employer is about 50% longer for union members than for non-union members.
Right.
And that translates into a lot more sanity, as you said. People can breathe a lot easier. They can plan a lot more. They're much more willing to then put money into an emergency savings account, into kids' college funds, and they also end up saving more in a 401k, for instance.
Yeah, I remember I worked for a trucking company for a number of years, and it was a unionized company, and obviously we made really good wages and benefits and all that. And the company actually made the argument all the time to customers that we have a very stable workforce. They had less than a 2% turnover rate in this nationwide corporation. And they were proud of that. They were proud of the fact that they had people there who were stable, and they made that part of their sales pitch. Somehow that's changed over the last 20 years to the point where now that's almost a liability, I think.
It is a liability if you're running a company where you're constantly chasing after the next quarter's profits and you need to keep your CEO's stock options happy and high. But it's definitely not a liability when you're actually trying to run a real business, not just manipulating the stock market. This might seem like sort of overstating the case, but you look at the numbers, right? When you look at corporate data, for the past 30 years, corporations have used every single dollar in after-tax profits to buy back their own shares or pay out dividends. There is not much left over for workers.
No.
And that business model is sort of coming to an end. Profits have been going down in a slowing economy amid the trade wars. And the only way businesses are now figuring out how to be profitable is basically make stuff again and sell more of the stuff, and that means they need more workers and they need to pay them better. And that sort of leads to these arguments that employers will do the right thing by workers and we should just be happy with that.
I don't buy that.
Yeah, and we shouldn't, because just as quickly as it comes, it will go. And I think we do need, if we want to have a real middle class, not just with higher wages, but also with secure wealth, where people have and can afford their home, where they can look forward to a secure retirement, where they can look forward to spending time with their family. That only comes through a strong labor movement.
Yeah, well, I've always said that I don't want employer-based health care. I don't want to see what the employers hold on to pensions. I would love, for instance, as a Teamster, the Teamsters hold my pension and our health care through joint plans. And while there may be some problems, I still think it's better than having all of that tied to the employer. And don't we have to move to a system away from employer-based health care? Because, I think the GM strike was a perfect example. The people went on strike. The first thing GM did was, we're cutting your health care.
Right. So the employer-based model, the employers don't like it.
Well, if the employers don't like it, Christian, and I hear this a lot, why the hell do they fight so hard to keep it? Why aren't they out there pushing for an alternative to get it off of their back? Because like, I'll tell you, I, as an employer, don't want to have to search out those benefits either. So why do we still have this system?
Because we don't have a good alternative. Where the employers are nervous is with the multi-employer plans, that if I'm like an employer and I go into the multi-employer plan and I do my thing and then one of the other employers goes under, I'm on the hook for that. There is a little bit of that where the employers are nervous about this. But we have seen in several cases in the last 20 years sort of big employers joining actually multi-employer plans among the airlines, for instance, in the early 2000s. The other part is there is definitely sort of employers, especially in the airlines, were eager to get rid of their pension plans. And if there was a multi-employer plan, what may be a Teamsters plan or maybe a machinist plan or something like that, they would go in there. Otherwise, the only way for them to really get rid of the pension plan was to say, like, I'm going to stop the pension and I'm going to offer a 401k plan instead. And that is, to some degree, a policy failure. We're rather unimaginative. You can actually stand up what we call sort of benefit platforms outside of the employer world. And in fact, that is, and you don't have to have this necessarily be a joint trustee plan. You can have union members in there and you can have non-union members in it. That's completely doable.
Right. I look at what California is doing, what CalPERS is doing in California, opening up the state system to other employers, to smaller employers, to give access to pension plans to their members. I think that's a step in the right direction.
And there is actually an industry group that has been advocating for these benefit platforms. And there would be sort of basically, think sort of like a business that offers health plans and offers defined benefit pensions and other things, and employers, unionized and non-unionized, can join there. And then it's off the employer's plate, and you have stable benefits for everybody. And I think the employers like it because they do understand, at least sort of the smarter employers understand, that the peace of mind that comes from a stable retirement benefit is worth something. Obviously, the peace of mind that comes from having a stable job is worth more, but for that, you do need to have a union in the workplace. But if we want to have sort of real wealth security, we also need to maintain good retirement benefit pensions, in particular defined benefit pensions.
Because I know you've done the research on this, but you have to imagine that productivity and loyalty to the company comes with having good wages, having stable benefits, having stable employment. That just seems like common sense to me. So when I saw, and you alluded to the business...
Pensions.
What's that?
That's why we have pensions. Employers didn't offer, and a lot of employers don't offer pensions just because of their goodwill. They offer it in high-skilled workforces because they want the workers. And in many cases, think about sort of teacher pensions. They exist because the school systems want to hang on to experienced teachers.
Right, but you know what I was saying is, you know, you alluded to the business roundtable, the epiphany that they've recently had that, you know, the consumer matters, that the community matters, and that, oh, by the way, the workers seem to matter now, that it's no longer all about maximizing shareholder wealth and hooray for me and screw everybody else. And I thought it was interesting that, you know, they came out with this statement. And because, you know, I think the rest of us have known that they could care less about their customers or their workers or the community. And I don't think going forward it's going to get any better.
No, and I wasn't quite sure whether I should laugh or cry at that statement. Because we've known this and we've fought back at this and we said, like, this is an unsustainable model. And now the business roundtable is like, trust us, we'll fix these things. And I was like, no, you've had your chance. And I think the going forward for us, the real solution is, okay, how do we really strengthen the labor movement? How do we protect unions? How do we protect workers? How do we get unions into, and union rights and collective bargaining rights, into what we call sort of the precarious or fissured workplace, sort of the gig economy? And I think what's been happening out on the West Coast, that SEIU won the rights to unionize the home health aides, I think that's a big signal. I think that teachers are walking off the jobs all across the country. I think those are big signals that there is real hope for the labor movement.
Yeah, but ultimately, for me, it comes back to these are political decisions. It's the people that we put into the halls of power, the people we put into Congress and the Senate. I look at right now, there was some hope that Virginia, having turned blue, would undo the right to work nonsense that's been there. And now I'm seeing, well, maybe that's not going to happen.
I don't know, but you're right. I can't predict the future, and I've learned my lessons not to do that. But the other part is, I think you're right. This is all a political decision. It was a political decision from previous administrations to go against the labor movement, not to protect workers' rights, not to enforce labor law when the opportunities exist. But then I also look at some of the campaigns at this point, the presidential campaigns, and I do have hope because there are innovative new ideas coming out. There are people pushing, and it doesn't feel like the same old lip service that Democratic candidates in particular pay to the labor movement. I think there is some real thought being put into, okay, what does a renewed labor movement, what does a renewed labor law look like in a changed workflows?
And, the thing is, I know people who have been in business for years and years, and I think back to an uncle who has had a business since the 60s. The first thing that he did when he started his business, he went to the local union and said, organize my workforce. I want them to have benefits. I want them to have, decent wages. I want them to be part of and to have the security of the job and all that. And I think, back to that era of this is a guy who was starting a business and wanted a partnership with his workforce. Now that doesn't happen today.
I'm not sure. I think there is sort of it's weird to me. When I listen to employers, especially in the high-skill workforce, they're like, well, and then this engineer and that worker comes to me and complains, and I don't want to deal with that. And I'm like, well, if you had a union, you didn't have to deal with this.
Right.
There is going to be an HR person on the management side, and there's going to be a union rep, and they're working it out, and you don't have to deal with it. But if you don't have a union, if you don't have a collective bargaining voice, you constantly have to deal with individual cases. And many people will be employees will, but when you're talking higher skilled workforces, you don't want to necessarily get rid of people because turnover is incredibly costly. Skilled work is very valuable. So you deal with this, and it's an incredible cost to the employer. So I don't understand why employers aren't more open, and I think there is sort of a ideology here that has emerged over the last, since the 1980s probably, that unions are bad, that has sunk in with employers, even against their own self-interest when, as you said, unions create more stable workforces. It
right.
streamlines the labor management process. All of these things, we know that. The literature shows us that. And as I said, the data shows us that in the end, you have a more financially secure labor force that then translates into a more productive labor force. And I think there is, it's not just politics, but I think there is ideology also plays into it. And it will take some time to turn the tide on that.
Right. But while you're talking about all those good things, at the end of the day, the CEO views his workplace as his kingdom. He's the king and they're the serfs. Do what I say or there's the door. That seems to me to be the driving motivation. And all those other things he'll do without, because ultimately they want to have final say. And look, unions want to have their workforce have a voice on the job.
That's true. But I think we're sort of the interest the line at this point is profits. They're high, but they haven't grown much in the last 2 years. And that's in the end what companies are worried about,
right.
especially their stock options. And so if you want to grow your business and you want to increase your profits, you have to start really going back to your core business and actually making more stuff and become more productive. Productivity is a real challenge, has become a real challenge in the last few years. Whatever companies thought they can do, like as you said, use their workers as more sort of a disposable thing in their kingdoms or fiefdoms, that's no longer working. And I think there is sort of a slow rethinking going on. I think unions can sort of push that along further and can also secure that and put a new sort of model in place when there is a union. As I said, I think that my biggest fear is that some companies like the Business Roundtable people changing their mind now, and as soon as things
turn south,
it's something goes. It doesn't have to be thousands. It's like somebody who knows what the business roundtable will decide next year in their joint statement.
That's a good point.
This is a club of multimillionaires and billionaires. Whatever they decide over lunch, that's ultimately what is going to drive.
Yeah.
And what we're interested in, what I think the country is interested in, is building a real working class and a strong and stable working class. And we can't wait for the business roundtable to finally act on the newfound goodwill towards working families.
I'm right there with you. Because you know what I know every one of those CEOs has? They have an employment contract.
Oh, yeah, and a golden parachute.
And I know what you know what most workers in this country don't have? An employment contract with a golden parachute.
Yes, it is.
So for me, that's
our world.
I'll take what you've got, please. I don't want to take yours away. I just want to make sure that everyone gets a little piece of it. Last question I've got for you. You know, again, you know, you look at the whole financial stability thing. You know, is there an area somewhere where we've kind of said this is what financially stable looks like? Thoughts?
Well, what do you mean, like in terms
like economically?
Of households?
I mean, I think you threw some numbers out in the article that caught my attention. I think it was like 36. Was it 33,000? You said was anyone around there was experiencing negative income via negative income?
Yeah, I mean, largely that's sort of our biggest problems. I mean, it's hard to pin down exactly the numbers, say, thresholds, because income volatility and income instability, sort of the what we call income shocks, negative income shocks, have actually moved up. So in the past, it used to be sort of, lower income people. At this point, on average, about 20% of American families experience a negative income shock in a year. And that has moved up the income scale from like low income to middle income. And that sort of is driving a lot of anxiety. That has these negative follow-on effects. If you're constantly worried, okay, well, am I going to lose my job? Am I going to lose my overtime? Am I going to see my hours being cut back at my employer? That makes it much harder to plan for the future. That makes it much harder to save. And that sort of translates into less wealth. And
right.
As I said, like for us, for David, Madeline and I, in our research, the sort of the really thing that stands out is the only way, like one entryway to really get to a point of financial security is job stability in collective bargaining is a major mechanism to create job stability, predictable schedules, predictable work schedules, and the ability that if things don't work out, you actually have a way to negotiate with your employer. You're not just being kicked out on the street.
Yeah, excellent points, all of the above. I hope people will take a look at the article in Forbes magazine, Unions, not companies, deliver real sustainable financial security, written by our friend Christian Weller. Christian, I appreciate you taking time for us. I hope you come back and talk with us real soon.
Anytime, Rick. Thank you very much for having me.
Good stuff, as always. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1938. That was the day that the National Federation of Telephone Workers was founded in New Orleans, Louisiana. Today, the union is known as the Communication Workers of America and represents 700,000 workers in a wide range of communication fields. Attempts to organize the telephone industry began as early as 1910 by the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. By the end of the decade, the IBEW had more than 200 telephone unions. Growth in the number of union members in the telephone industry was greatly impeded due to World War I. During the war, President Woodrow Wilson issued an order to, quote, hereby take possession and assume control and supervision of each and every telegraph and telephone system and every part thereof within the jurisdiction of the United States. He placed control of the industry under the authority of the
Postmaster General. After the war ended, telephone companies increasingly installed company unions as a way to control their workers' organizing efforts. Their aim was to stave off unionism from outside organizations. Nearly all of the IBEW locals lost their membership to company unions. But when Congress passed the Wagner Act in 1935, a new surge of independent unionism began in the telephone industry. In 1938, 31 organizations joined together in New Orleans to form the National Federation of Telephone Workers. It was a loose association of locally independent unions. But by 1947, it became clear that the union would have to form a strong national presence to negotiate with the nationwide companies. And the Communication Workers of America was born. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, I go back to, you know, what I was talking with a Christian. We've got to return to a day where the idea of union jobs equal better life. I mean, it's that simple. And you lay it out just the way Christian has in this article, which I highly suggest taking a look at. It's a quick read. The fact that you have some job security because you can't just be fired for no reason. The fact that, you know, what union wages are generally a little bit higher, 30% higher was the number that they were throwing out for a number of years. Defined benefit pensions are still in the union arena, not as much as they used to be, but there are still some. And I'm hoping there will be something of a fight back for that. And also health security. Union companies tend to have better health care benefits because unions demand it. It's part of the negotiating process. So if you have job security, health security, and retirement security, the rest of your life is going to be pretty decent. You're going to be okay. Because you know that, you know, if a kid gets sick or fall off their bike and break something, you know, you're not going to go broke. And that gives you the ability to maybe save a little bit. You know, to me, it's just a much better proposition for workers. And it's curious to me that you don't see people getting that. And this is what's happened to the labor movement over the last couple of decades, is it's become a political issue. For me, it shouldn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican and independent. It shouldn't matter. You should be saying, I want an employment contract. Every CEO in this country's got one. And I always love to point out the guy who was the former head of Home Depot, who became the CEO of Chrysler. When Home Depot fired him for doing a crappy job, he was given a $210 million golden parachute on the way out the door. Not because they wanted to, but because it was his contract. And I've said this from the beginning. I think it's the smartest thing for every worker to have a contract just like the CEOs do. That's simple. And, you know, I have my conservative friends. Well, you know, those unions support Democrats. Yes, because Democrats support unions. The attacks that we've seen have all come from Republicans. This is not new. Go back to the Taft-Hartley era. Go back to the fact that Republicans, over the veto of Harry Truman, rammed through the worst employment legislation possible and created out of whole cloth this concept of a right-to-work scheme that has no rights or work attached to it. All it is a right to work for less, in less safe environments, with less security, less health care, less pensions, but somehow that's your right. Hey, I've got the right. It's insane. And I used to say, yeah, you have the right to work in crummy conditions for poverty wages and no benefits. You have that right. But then I quickly realized that, wait a second, if enough of you nitwits do this, eventually it's going to be me that has to work for poverty wages in crummy working conditions with no benefits. And that's where we are today. We're in a position where, guess what? The pendulum has swung. And it's all in the power, all the power is in the hands of the employers. And then we get this, oh, well, look what the employer gives us. Well, look what they're giving you. The fact that 60% of the people in this country can't come up with $1,000, 40% of the people can't come up with $400 is mind-blowing to me. But it comes back to, you know, basically what's happened in the work in the workplace. And until we say enough, I don't think things are going to change. I'm hoping we're at that moment. I'm hoping people are coming around to it, but we'll see. Today, evidently, Donald Trump is asking the Supreme Court to block Congress from seeing his tax returns. You knew this was coming, right? Yesterday, the court said, nope, you got to show him 8 years of them. Today, he has asked his Supreme Court. And this is one of those moments where I got to think the Supreme Court's not even going to take it. Because I guess the deal that was struck between Cyrus Vance's office and the Trump lawyers was that if the Supreme Court took the case this term, so maybe we'll find out if the court's going to take it or if they're going to just say, no, we're not taking it, and then it becomes law. But there's also the part of me that goes, you know, maybe the Supreme Court should take it. I mean, if I were on the court, I would want to take it just to go, you know, kind of like as a parent you do with your kids. Okay, let me hear this. Like when the kids do something really stupid, you go, oh, I got to hear this. This is one of those moments where you got to hear what this president believes he's entitled to, which first and foremost is this idea that the president doesn't have to follow the law. That's what this is saying. I'm the president. I don't have to follow the law. And exactly, as my wife said, you're not the boss of me. I'm in charge. I'm the man. And then the other argument is, you know, the two-year-old argument. I just don't wanna. The other argument. So I would like to see a qualified lawyer step into court and just cry, I don't wanna. I think that would be hysterical. Because that's basically the argument here. I don't wanna. No, you can't make me. What happened to the party of responsibility? What happened to the party of institution? What happened? Jeez. Also, remember a couple weeks ago there was a little dust up over Trump saying that they're going to hold the G7 summit at his golf club down in Miami, the Doral. And then quickly after, everyone's going, whoa, wait a minute. Now you've gone too far. Where Republicans actually went to Camp David screaming, no, you're killing us. He pulled out one of the few times. Evidently now the RNC has stepped up to fill that void. Evidently they're going to hold their winter meeting at the Doral there in Miami. Cause hey, nothing says, we're going to line your pockets. Like, you know, we'll go to your crummy place and fill the void. There you go. Also, here's one of my favorite little tidbits of the day. Amazon evidently is, I'm not sure if they're suing. Because, you know, it's one of these things where you go, they're protesting the Pentagon awarding a $10 billion contract to Microsoft. Evidently, the Pentagon is looking for a cloud. And I know they're in the sky. No, but an IT cloud. And evidently, Amazon has the best. I guess they control, you know, like almost 50% of the market. Microsoft, somewhere around 15-16% of the market goes to Microsoft. Amazon was thought to be the shoe-in because the industry claims they're the best, they're all that. But Amazon is going, hey, we're not getting it because, guess, Donald Trump hates us because the Washington Post always picks on him by tracking all the lies and all the BS that he tells. So they're going to move it to a different place. I'm going to find this interesting to see how this plays out. Two private companies battling it out in public, maybe in the courts, over where the taxpayer dollars go. I mean, this is going to be really interesting to me because, you know, before, you know, the government had the power to be able to, you know, decide which way they went, and nobody would dare question them. This is interesting that Amazon is so big and possibly so powerful that they could influence the Pentagon. So to me, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, just to see how much power Amazon has. Now, look, I'm not a Trump supporter, but I agree with him on the Amazon thing. Way too big. And maybe someday we'll use some of those anti-monopoly laws that we've got on the books. Maybe someday. Just a thought. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1903. Working women from around the nation founded the National Women's Trade Union League in Boston. The organization's founders included female reformers, working-class women, as well as women from wealthy families. The purpose of the organization was to assist in the organization of women wage workers into trade unions, and thereby to help them secure conditions necessary for healthful and efficient work and to obtain a just reward for such work. One of the inspirations for the Women's Trade Union League was the work of Settlement House organizer Jane Addams. The Women's Trade Union League recognized that women across economic classes were united by what they called the bonds of womanhood. Wealthy league members donated money to the cause. They often served as spokeswomen and arranged for legal representation for workers when necessary. When the league was founded, the trade union movement was male-dominated. The male trade unionists worried more women in the labor market would drive down men's wages. Often union leaders were unwilling to allow women into their ranks. The Women's Trade Union League was one of the primary organizers of female garment workers, particularly in New York City and Chicago. The league was a key supporter of the 1909 New York City shirtwaist workers' strike, also known as the Uprising of 20,000. The league was also a vocal advocate for the women's suffrage movement. The Women's Trade Union League disbanded in 1950, and in 1974, the Coalition of Labor Union Women was founded in Chicago to continue the fight to ensure women have a voice in the labor movement. However, women workers still earn about 80 cents on the dollar compared with men. The work of the Women's Trade Union League remains unfinished. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday you have Trump sitting next to a dictator saying that we've got the oil. Our troops are there to protect the oil only. And he was very honest about it. You know, and look, maybe you know, that kind of honesty is refreshing. Maybe to finally be able to say, you know what, we're just rape and pillage. That's the new slogan. That's the bumper sticker. Maybe that's okay. So that was yesterday. We're evidently going against international law, and we're grabbing the oil. Today, Donald Trump, I guess, is forcing this idea of forcing South Korea to pay 500% more to have our troops in South Korea to guard against the North Koreans. And understand, if you remember the love affair, you know, Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, they were in love, and he said so. It was a love affair, and they wrote beautiful letters to each other, which is creepy on a whole lot of levels. But even still, what he pitched, and you haven't heard a lot from him lately, is that everything was going to go wonderfully in North Korea. It was going to be great, and everything was going to be terrific. They had those in-person meetings, and then nothing. Now, look. I said then, and I'll say now, not against talking to the North Koreans. During the Cold War, there was a bat phone in the Oval Office that, you know, went right to the Kremlin. And, you know, the two leaders had direct access to each other, even when we hated each other. And they were trying to meddle in our country. Not succeeding, but, you know, I guess no phone can't talk. So I'm not against the idea of talking. Not against the idea of having communications. But this seems kind of interesting to me. Now, I think my problem with Trump is that he's such a narrow thinker. Now, I'm not the brightest bulb in the box, but I look at this. The reason we're in South Korea, okay, we're guarding the South Koreans a little bit against the North, but we're really there because of China. Understand, geopolitically, strategically speaking, having your military right there gives you a good tactical position. You've already got infrastructure in place in case something goes horribly awry. And we do this stuff all around the world. Now, you could argue, as some have, that we shouldn't be interventionalists. We can have those arguments. And if this is the goal, if the goal is to pull us out of everywhere and bring, you know, close all the bases that we have in, what, something 140 countries around the world. If that's the plan, then, you know, that's his right to do. He is the commander-in-chief. He is the chief foreign policy guy. If that's the goal, then say that. That's our stated goal. We're looking to get out. This just seems like a shakedown. It seems like, well, you know, we could use a little bit of extra money. And understand, this has always been his gig. It's always been about the shakedown. It's always been about the con. Here's where we are today, though. Now, understand, North Korea has been, you know, shooting off some missiles again. Haven't heard much from the president on that. Curious. Where's the tough talk there? I don't know if they're still exchanging notes under the desk. I don't know. But it seems curious that we haven't heard a lot. Haven't heard a lot. Now, evidently, they're demanding this increase in funding, which you go, okay, that's, you know, it's a good bit of money. But what happens if they say no? Take your ball and go home. We're giving you nothing. Now, do we end up getting into a conflict with an ally? And this is the thing that I have probably the biggest problem with his foreign policy, is he's completely upending all of our alliances to where eventually we're standing with no one. Or worse yet, we're standing with murderers and dictators and not even playing the game well. I mean, whether you believe the impeachment is proper or not, whether you believe he did anything wrong on the phone call or not, if you're that narrow, can you agree that allowing the Ukrainians to fall into the hands of the Russians is not a good thing? Can we agree on that? Can we agree allowing the Russian Putin and those folks to get the old band back and recreate the Soviet Union is not probably a good thing for democracy across the world? Can we agree on that? Because ultimately, for me, while the phone call is bad, all this other stuff that we're hearing in this testimony is that much worse. And you go, well, it was just Ukraine. Well, now we're shaking down South Korea. You know, Japan next? You know, where are we going next? And, you know, like I said, I'm not a military expert, but it seems so short-sighted. And this is one of those things that, you know, I don't know how it got into his mind. And this is the scary thing about this presidency. There's no long-term thought process. Everything is at the you know, the rote level. Everything's at the, you know, the impulse, the id level. Oh, I got an idea. I have to do it now. And then, you know, like a child, once it's in between the ears, once you're thinking about it, you can think of nothing else. I want a cheeseburger. And that's all you can think about. This to me seems like one of those things. And the question is at the end of all this, hopefully soon, what's that leave the next administration to clean up? The world is on fire. You know, I was looking at a Washington Post article about all the stuff going on around the world in places like Bolivia and Hong Kong and, you know, just all over the place. All the strife, all of the protests, all of the craziness going on. And you've got this administration that's just, wow. But again, it comes back to, you know, as the world is in chaos. I mean, you have more attacks on the Gaza Strip. You've got Chile and entering its 26th day of protests, huge demonstrations. Bolivia, you know, I don't know enough about it, but it seems like a coup to me. You've got flooding in Venice. You've got the world in in chaos. And, well, we've got a guy who believes, hey, the laws don't apply to me. I'm above the law. Scary times, my friend. Cannot wait for it to end. Quick break. Right back.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.